special Saturday edition of the Dunktown Basketball Podcast. I apologize for the sporadic schedule. I've been at the Sloan Conference out in the East Coast for the last couple of days, and finally now getting time to catch up and record a little bit. Got a little bit of an eclectic menu today. We're going to talk about the Warriors' chances of getting to 73 wins. Lots of news, signings, injuries to catch up on as well. And then maybe if we have time, we'll talk about the sixth man of the year race, since Danny and I were both thinking about it, and you recently wrote a piece on it as well. So, hello, Danny. I went too long without letting you talk.
You can always go a long time without letting me talk. I talk too much.
So let's talk about the Warriors first. I'm looking at their schedule, and it looks to me like they have maybe seven games that I would look at as pretty much automatic wins, like not really in question. So they play the Suns tonight at home. That's going to be a win. New Orleans at home on Monday. That's a win. Wednesday at home, Knicks. That's a pretty clear win as well. I would say that at Timberwolves, granted it's a third game in four nights, that's probably a pretty clear win. Dallas at home, a win. Sixers at home, a win. Wizards at home, probably almost certainly a win. And then Wolves at home and Grizzlies at home. So how many is that? What's that, like seven or eight?
I think that's eight.
Yeah, all right. So that's eight. That leaves 10 games, and they have six losses right now. If they can get three or less losses in those 10 games, then they set the record 73-9. Will they do it?
I think they will. It's weird to say that, and one of the other major considerations beyond, you know, the games that we'll talk about is that the schedule might work to their disadvantage in the set. Well, we'll have to see, because I think they'll have the one seed locked up by the time they face the Spurs twice in the last week, and since the Spurs have a better bench than the Warriors do, I actually think that might favor them.
You talking about the Warriors or the Spurs?
Might favor the Spurs, depending on, but the Warriors push it a little bit and, you know, just basically do enough, because the Warriors starters can obviously beat the Spurs bench.
Yeah, here are some of the games that I was looking at as questionable. They on the road at Dallas next Friday, back-to-back in San Antonio on Saturday. That's obviously one you'd really look at. That's on ABC. And then Clippers at home Wednesday the 23rd. Jazz on the road Wednesday the 30th.
Tail end of a back-to-back.
Yeah, that's true too. And that's never easy, especially going east. You lose an hour into mountain time zone. The first one's at home. Boston at home on the 1st, Portland at home on the 3rd, Spurs at home on the 7th, and then they finish with away on a back-to-back Grizz and Spurs, and then Memphis at home on Wednesday, April 13th. So, I mean, those two Spurs games, I think you probably would have to say that they are underdogs in both those games, the two road games.
Yeah, I would agree with that, and I was thinking out loud when I was writing a piece for Warriors World that's not out yet about when the last time this team was an underdog was. Was it maybe the Cleveland game? But I think they were favored in that one, the Cleveland game in Cleveland.
Yeah, that one was really one of their bad stretches. They were coming off getting killed in Detroit the game before that. So, no, yeah, I think, I mean, a lot of these projection systems actually say that the Spurs have been better than the Warriors this year. So if they're on the road, that's definitely...
For sure.
I think they have to win one of those two games. If they lose both of those games, it's going to get real dicey to only lose one more among the rest of these, especially now with Andre Iguodala potentially going to miss some time. We don't know how much yet, but I just seeing how severe that was, how he limped off, I think that's going to be like a week or two injury at least.
Yeah, that would be my instinct too. It is fortunate that for the most part, the teams they're facing in the next little bit, fortunate for the Warriors that they don't have those perimeter scorer types for the most part. You know, the Pelicans have Anthony Davis, Melo is one guy, but the Knicks just aren't good enough. So, you know, that it'll definitely make it harder, especially because of the role he plays in stabilizing the bench defense. And that's something that we saw, or that I saw covering them this last week when he was out most of the time. But, you know, most of these games are still in the near term or ones they should win. But I think that also, if he's out that long, makes it more likely that they split that two-gamer with Dallas and San Antonio, which is how I've kind of always seen that pairing. Because the Dallas game is kind of a trap game, which is actually more in line with what they've lost this season.
Yeah, I guess that's true, huh? And Dallas is going to be fighting for their lives, obviously. The Clippers game at home, if Blake Griffin doesn't play in that, which it's starting to sound like, he's still actually, as he's been ramping up his activity, it's more been that quad tendon that he initially was supposed to be coming back from right before he punched Matthias Hesse in the face and broke his hand. That supposedly is actually giving him a little bit of trouble, so he's had to scale back a little bit. So if he's, I would imagine he's not going to be back by the 23rd, which is only, what, like 10 days away now. So,
well, especially because he has to sit four games after he's cleared because of the suspension.
Yeah, so there's almost no chance then that he'll be in that game.
Right.
I mean, you'd have to, and that's actually kind of too bad for the Clippers. They're getting to the point now where you're a little bit worried about their ability to reintegrate him and to get him back in shape, especially if, you know, he hasn't been able to work out as hard as you would like. And him getting into great shape is really important for the playoffs, too, because of the huge burden that they place on him sometimes in the playoffs. So that is a little bit concerning for the Clippers. But my ultimate prediction on the Warriors, I think they get to 72-10. I think they're going to tie it. I don't think they're going to break it. And coincidentally, perhaps not coincidentally, that's what the projection systems seem to indicate as well. They're predicting 72-10. And it'd be pretty amazing if that Lakers game was the reason why they didn't make it. But they've also had plenty of wins that they kind of pulled out of their asses here, too. So
yeah, the other story that I've been thinking about more is the possibility of them going 41-0 at home, which would be, in some ways, would be more remarkable just because that's unbreakable.
I totally disagree. Oh, it's unbreakable.
Yeah,
I guess so. I still disagree that that's, I think the overall wins record is more impressive than the home court advantage one. I'm much more focused on that one.
Oh, guy from Chicago. Well, actually, they're both Bulls records, so that's fine.
No, I'm totally rooting for them to break the record, by the way. Even though I was 16 years old in Chicago, nurturing my nascent fandom back then when that Bulls team won it, I'm definitely rooting for them to break it. I have a little bit of a dilemma, too, because the Nike Hoop Summit, which is maybe my favorite event of the year to go to, is that second to last week of the season, and they're going to have all these home games, including that Thursday at home against the Spurs, and I have to decide whether I'm going to go to that or not. I mean, they have three home games, essentially, I'd be missing if I go to the Hoop Summit, or whether I want to stick around and potentially see history. I got to just make a last-minute decision on that one.
It'll be fun.
All right, what do we got here for news?
There's a lot of it. Sadly, much of it is injury-related. I think we should start with the teams with the most playoff relevance, though you can argue the injuries don't necessarily go in that order. And Memphis, Mike Conley is out with Achilles tendonitis for 3 to 4 weeks. Mario Chalmers tore his Achilles tendon. He's out for the remainder of this season. And as a unrestricted free agent, that is really unfortunate for a lot of reasons, but that's one of the bigger ones.
Yeah, he actually has been released already.
Correct, because they wanted to clear the roster spot.
Yeah, and so they will not have his bird rights. Not that it really matters. They're probably going to be a cap room team anyway if they wanted to bring him back. But yeah, I mean, that's really a shame for him, because I think he's a guy who has actually been pretty underrated through his career. His contributions to that big three team as a guy who didn't need the ball in his hands, could defend, had great instinct for steals, and could shoot 40% on open threes. And he had some huge shots, too, for those Heat teams. And he was just kind of known more as the guy who got yelled at. But he actually really worked pretty well as a point guard, especially one who wasn't really paid that well. And you think about the fact that he didn't play as much, that they struggled in large part because they didn't have a great option at point guard that first year. Then they were starting Mike Bibby. That was probably a big part of why things didn't work out for them in the finals. And so I think he is an underrated player. He probably will never get a contract now that's more than like about the $4 million he was making. And with a bad point guard market, you know, he could have gotten $6 or $7 million. And I don't know if that's going to happen for him now.
One of the other kind of parts of that, people have talked about, oh, well, why did they release him? And you talked about the cap space part, but also his hold was a little over $8 million. And cap holds are valuable. We talked about this a lot with Kawhi Leonard last summer. Cap holds are valuable when a guy is going to get paid more than that. When he's going to be paid less, really what holding him means is that with bird rights that you can give him bigger raises and things like that. But that's not going to be a big issue with Mario Chalmers.
Memphis has now signed a couple of players. They signed Alex Stevenson, who just was not re-signed after a second 10-day with the Clippers. I actually have not really seen him play at all, frankly. I don't know much about him. Briante Weber actually played 40 minutes last night. They signed him from Sioux Falls, which is the Heat affiliate. The Heat were rumored to want to bring him on, but they could not do so because of their luxury tax concerns. They really only have about $45,000, so they have to wait. It basically, a minimum contract costs a little over $5,000 a day, so they basically had to wait until their 8 days left, I think, in the regular season before they could have brought him on. And Memphis, now needing some help there, beat them to the punch, and now they're going to sign Ray McCallum, too.
Yeah, and they're going to use Ray McCallum tonight, I believe, against the Hawks, if they can.
Yeah, that's crazy. And Conley being out with the Achilles tendonitis 3 to 4 weeks, that's like pretty much right when the playoffs would be starting. He has been struggling with this injury really since the new year turn, just about. And I guess their thought finally was, hey, we're playing okay without this guy. I think we are good for getting into the playoffs really just about no matter what happens. So let's just see if we can get him healthy. And also just going into his free agent year, I mean, anytime you have an issue with your Achilles, then you wonder about, oh, you know, what if he tears it? And I'm sure that he also is a little concerned about that, given that, you know, he's probably going to get, he could have over $100 million on the line, essentially.
Yeah, and that's something also to consider that we were going to talk about a little bit when we get into the kind of the meat of this. But Memphis, over the last couple weeks, especially since the break, has put themselves into a position where they're pretty stable in the five spot. You know, I talked about this a little bit a couple days ago, that they're actually closer right now to the Clippers in four than they are to Portland in the sixth spot. And so, you know, they, as long as they win the games that they should win, then they'll be
fine. Are there any of those games anymore? I mean, they're relying on Lance Stephenson to get 33 points off the bench like they did last night. I mean, this has to run out at some point. I mean, Dave Yeager is doing a great job. Their players have been doing a great job. They've been playing extremely hard, but this has to run out. I mean, they're playing with, like, you know, three quarters D-League guys available right now.
You know what? I was going to say the Suns, and then I remembered what's happened.
Yeah.
They play the Suns and the Lakers back-to-back in a couple weeks, and they should win both those. That's probably enough.
Yeah. Yeah. A game I was actually at last night was Celtics-Rockets. Jay Crowder suffered what is now being called a high ankle sprain. That is big trouble for the Celtics. They were looking like a pretty good bet to be the number three seed, but they desperately, desperately need him. And we saw what happened down the end. The Rockets went small, and they were forced to play Evan Turner at the four, Marcus Smart at the three. They even played Marcus Smart at the four a little bit last night with Terry Rozier coming in because they just didn't really want to play with two bigs. Getting Kelly Olynyk back, I think, will help them a little bit, although the rumors around him are not that great. They said he's not quite feeling good, and, you know, it could be even, you know, a week or two before he's back from kind of what the scuttlebutt is. So this is a key stretch for the Celtics, because they really, really want to be in that opposite bracket from Cleveland. If they get down to the fourth seed, they're going to have to play Cleveland in the second round. I think they got, if they could be healthy and be the three seed, I think they got relatively close to even money chance against the Raptors in the second round.
Yeah, what this does is it opens up basically all the seeding possibilities outside of 1 and 2 in the Eastern Conference, because they could I think they're still going to be in, but they could go a lot of different places. They might even end up, depending on how this goes, they could end up in the 3-6 on the other side. And that wouldn't be the worst thing in the world, because I actually think if they're not going to get the three, that would be the best place for them to go. But opening that up, especially considering a lot of us aren't sold on Miami, who's the other team that is closest to them, you know, this could go in a lot of different directions now. It could be huge for Charlotte, for one.
Jay Crowder is essential to them. I think that without him, they are going to be close to a 500 team. He's just so important. His ability to go small, guard fours. He's their best defender on the wing against anyone who has some heft. Like, Avery Bradley really struggled with the strength of James Harden last night when Crowder was out. He helps them switch. You're really going to have trouble switching a lot if you're going to play someone like Smart at the four or the three. I mean, he'll fight real hard, but, you know, doesn't have the size that Crowder does. He can contribute a lot on the glass because he's a former power forward. I mean, there's a reason he, as a 3-and-D guy, those guys are really hard to replace. There's a reason those guys get paid. And, I mean, they are 39-27. The Heat are nipping at their heels, a half game behind. And the Hornets actually could potentially pass them also. So that might be how they end up getting into the fifth seed or sixth seed. I don't know. And then the Hawks are 38-29 also. So those teams are actually all kind of closer than you might think.
Hawks are 36-29, but just one.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, it's in like a gray font on 538. Yeah. Looking at it right now.
No worries.
But yeah, I think certainly if Crowder misses 4 weeks, which with a high ankle sprain, I think seems about right. Harrison Barnes missed more time than that. I think that, yeah, they could very easily end up in the sixth seed, and then they probably would not fall behind the Pacers or the Pistons or the Bulls. But I think I would rather be the sixth seed than the fourth or fifth seed, frankly, if I were them. I don't think any of those teams scare them particularly more than anyone else. I mean, who do you think is the team they would least want to play out of the Heat, Hawks, and Hornets? Heat if Chris Bosh is back?
Yeah, Heat if Bosh. That seems like a cop-out, though. I would say then, excluding that possibility, probably the Hornets. The Hornets are just a good team, and their defensive ability, though they can't really exploit. Well, I'm thinking about whether they could exploit Boston's interior defense. Not particularly well.
Yeah, they don't. And they're spacing. I mean, I guess. Yeah, they don't have a ton of guys who are going to drive to the rim and finish over Boston in their lack of rim protection. So anyway, yeah, we're probably getting a little far afield here, but I think it's hard to see the Celtics now with this injury finishing in the third seed, especially if Olynyk is still going to miss, you know, a matter of additional weeks.
Yeah, how amazing would it be if the Hornets ended up with a three seed, considering Kid Gilchrist basically missed the whole season?
Yeah, that would be remarkable. I mean, that was by the way, we didn't get a ton of predictions right, but one we did get was best bet Hornets over 32 wins. Yeah, that was pretty good.
Yeah.
Andre, we mentioned his ankle sprain. You were at the game last night. Dame Lillard had a little bit of talking before the game about how he didn't really want to be compared to Steph Curry, which makes sense. You know, I think for his branding, he doesn't want to be considered just an off-brand Steph Curry. He wants to be his own guy. That all makes sense. Steve Kerr had tried to compliment him, as you'll recall, after he had that 50 against the Warriors by saying he looked like Steph Curry out there. He was like 5 out of 17 was the competitive portion of the game. He was like 2 out of 15 or something. So he also then injured Andre on sort of a Matthew Dellavedova type dive on the floor. I mean, what did you think of that play?
I had a look of it live. I've still never seen a replay, as crazy as that sounds, just because you're in the locker room and all that kind of stuff. But what bothered me about it was the game was already done. It was a 20-point game that the Warriors had clearly outclassed them. And I'm fine with guys, you know, being aggressive and diving for balls. But I think at a certain point, especially when it's still starters versus starters, you want to be a little bit cognizant and respectful of the situation and not try to do anything that can facilitate the injury of another person.
I'm of two minds on this. One is you play hard all the time. Dame doesn't have any kind of a reputation the way Deli does. I mean, he's had 4 or 5 of those incidents within a short stretch at the end of last season and in the playoffs. And it was a pretty similar play to when he injured Kyle Korver. I do think that there is this fetishizing of diving on the floor in basketball to where, you know, if you're diving, kids shouldn't be taught to dive through players' legs like that, whereas coaches really kind of laud that sort of behavior. But yeah, on the other side, it was a 25-point game. He was clearly frustrated. There's some circumstantial evidence there, you know, that he's just kind of pissed off, and that maybe because of that, I think that made him more reckless. I don't think he was trying to hurt Iguodala. And it's kind of ironic for Andre because he very fastidiously does not dive on the floor, especially during the regular season. He's not trying to get hurt on a play like that. And this is actually the second one this year where someone has basically dove through his legs. And the first time he almost got injured. And the second time, you know, he actually is probably going to miss some time now, you would imagine.
Yeah, the first time, I don't remember who the opponent was, but I thought he was going to be out for a little while, and then he was okay.
Yeah, I want to say maybe like the Nets or something. No, it was probably more recent than that. It was like one of those games where they're kind of struggling at
home. I actually
home
think it was
team.
The Nets. I think you're right on that. It was one of their rotation guys. I can't remember who it was, though. But yeah, I saw the play happen in slow motion and just thought it was going to happen. Because those plays, regardless of who's involved, you can always tell it ahead of time from the angle we have. It's just like, oh, this is going to go badly.
The Spurs signed Kevin Martin. They waived Rasul Butler. To do so, Matt Bonner somehow survives again. I guess just because he's a good locker room guy. He's been an organizational soldier for so long, I would be very surprised if he does not eventually ascend into a role with the team after his playing days are over, which could be after this year. You know, I think Kevin Martin is a more better upside guy than Butler, although Butler had given them some decent rotation minutes at times. More injury news. Jimmy Butler played an awesome game against the Rockets and then suddenly had swelling in his left knee after playing 21 out of 24 minutes in the first half.
I'm having deja vu.
So he was actually went to see Dr. James Andrews, who had been consulting but had not examined him. Andrews examined him. It was basically for kind of peace of mind after there was more swelling and pain. He's supposed to try and be back within the next couple of days. But again, just – and of course, Derrick Rose then also missed the last game with a strained adductor muscle after playing 36 minutes against San Antonio the night before in a game that was never really that close. Do you think that the Bulls should be reducing his minutes given the fact that they are fighting for their absolute playoff lives right now and really just cannot afford to lose any more games?
I'm not sure the focus should be on reducing them in the aggregate. It should be mitigating it when you can. So, you know, if it's a game that's out of hand, then you give them a little bit of extra rest, and you can adjust that on the fly. I don't think you necessarily have to put a minutes restriction or something like that. You just need to think about it in a little bit of a different way.
Yeah, and the report was that he injured that late in the game against the Spurs when, I mean, they were down 10, they were down 15 in the fourth quarter. That's one of those times where being honest with yourself about, all right, look, this is an all-time great team. We don't have Jimmy Butler. We're down 12 with 5 minutes left in the fourth or whatever, you know, maybe even 15. We have a 1% or 2% chance of a comeback in this game. Let's just be honest with ourselves and pack it in and, you know, maybe try and bring in the scrubs, but press or something, go with some high variance strategy. Probably won't work, but, you know, maybe that could have saved Derrick Rose an injury. I mean, I think you probably have a greater chance in those situations, unless it's one where you're really, you know, your season is going to end and there's no tomorrow. You might as well just pack it in with a guy like Rose. And as you said, take the opportunity when you can to rest him, because it seems like every time he plays more than 30 minutes, he suffers some soft tissue injury and has to miss a game or two.
You're also not bound to that strategy. If the guys make it close and that 1% chance goes to 20%, then you can make a change and if you want to and bring the starters back in. You're not bound to that by the rest of the game. It's not like baseball where when you pull a guy, he's out for the rest of the contest.
All right, let's get to another one. Jahlil Okafor had been suffering from periodic knee discomfort. He is now having surgery on his right knee and will miss 6 weeks. It sounds like this is to a little bit of a meniscus trim, because it would be a lot longer than 6 weeks. If it were a pair, that'd be like a 3-4 month injury. Not a great sign for someone who is carrying a lot of weight on him already, but at least there's an answer as to why he was feeling the pain, and it seems like a small surgery and probably not something that'll be an issue for him, you know, in the next 3-4 years, but maybe it could be down the road. But more ill health luck for the Sixers ultimately.
It's unfortunate, of course, in that way. It also does give them a chance to evaluate Nerlens Noel playing, you know, as the starter with Ish Smith, see how that affects their defense and see how it works with him in that role. You can try some out with him with a stretch four, however you want to really do that, and get a sense of what you're looking at with him, which is really important, because as it's been well documented how they can kind of struggle together, but one of the ways that they've handled that is sometimes by playing Nerlens with the backups a little bit. So I'm excited to see how that works out.
Yeah, that's a good point. And the Sixers also, we need to congratulate them on winning their ninth game of the season, so they will now not set the record for least wins in an 82-game season. Good job by them. And I think actually with Ja out, they might actually play a little bit better. Also a chance for them to get more of a look at Rashawn Holmes, someone who we have both liked in shorter minutes, has been awesome finishing around the rim, has some ability to protect the basket, and is supposed to be at least a little bit of a three-point shooter. I would like to see more out of him as well. So that'll be a reason to watch a Sixers game or two as we're getting down to the end of the season. What else do we have?
According to my former colleague Shams Charania of The Vertical, the Wizards are signing Marcus Thornton.
Yeah, he actually played against the Jazz, a game that they lost in fairly desultory fashion last night. I don't think he started off very well, but they waived Gary Neal to sign him. He basically is Gary Neal. Maybe a little more dynamic off the dribble, a little bit less of a guy who can just make wide open threes reliably. So I don't know. I don't think he really moves the needle much for them either way, but they have all these injuries in the backcourt, including Brad Beal. So they signed him and, he'll play, but maybe he's the type of guy who could maybe win them a game or two if he gets hot, but probably won't.
Is being a swingman on the Wizards basically the new being the drummer of Spinal Tap? I mean, they're all hurt. It seems like you just can't survive in that role.
Thank you for filling that in, because I actually didn't know that was a joke. But
really? I'm so disappointed in you.
Don't ever be disappointed in me not knowing something about pop culture.
Well, yeah, but
I can't even say the word pop culture. That's how out of touch I am.
But, I mean, Spinal Tap has a lot of the same people that later became involved in The Simpsons. So, like, Harry Shearer is in it. I don't know if Chris Guest has ever done anything with Simpsons, but anyway.
Frank Isola reporting that Phil Jackson wants Kurt Rambis to return as head coach next season. James Dolan has to approve that. If I were James Dolan, I probably would not approve that. But this is just Phil's big weakness here. It's really becoming this. And a lot of people have written now, we can add to the chorus that his slavish devotion to the triangle is not working. And maybe just, even if you want to dispute whether the system is antiquated or not, I think that it kind of is these days, with the lack of spacing, the lack of three-point shooting, how much more difficult it is to enter the ball into the post on the strong side and really do anything because of the way that teams can zone now. We are not in a strict man-to-man system any longer. All that, the biggest problem, I think, beyond that is there aren't any good coaches who coach the triangle that are out there.
I think that's an important point, and something that is connected and a little bit different than that is also the idea of personal comfort. And so Phil Jackson's coaching tree, his disciples, just aren't strong. So whether that's really triangle related, a lot of GMs want to hire a coach that they know that they're comfortable with. And if that's what he's going for, the options aren't very good. So you can talk about that as being a triangle thing, and I know a lot of people do. I'm not completely sure that that's all to blame, because when your coaching tree kind of looks like the Charlie Brown Christmas tree, it's hard to find a good coach.
Yeah, maybe Luke Walton is the only one, but none of these guys, you can talk about the offense all you want, none of these guys has ever coached an above average defense as a head coach. Brian Shaw, their defense was miserable. Kurt Rambis, the Timberwolves were some of the worst defenses in NBA history when he was there. So there's really, and Derek Fisher was a total noob when he came in. So there's really kind of nobody left at this point. So I don't know. We'll see. I mean, that is a real problem. I think just from a pure personnel standpoint, Phil has done okay, especially drafting KP. But if you can't get a decent coach in there, this is a team that, unless they can get a big star in free agency, and it's been reported that Kevin Durant will not consider the Knicks, both because they aren't that good and maybe because of how they treated his buddy Derek Fisher, they're going to have a coach in there that's going to get this team to overperform. And I don't see anyone like that in the triangle coaching tree, and especially because they're going to have competition for Luke Walton probably from the Lakers, and I'd much rather coach the Lakers than the Knicks at this point.
You also have a more short-term concern, which is something that their former coach Mike D'Antoni was good at, which is that when you don't have a ton of draft assets, one of the hopes would be that you can convert some of your existing talent into future assets, guys that will contribute long-term. And you want a coach that was willing to run, ideally, or something like that, you could get a little bit more out of it in that sense. You know, maybe somebody, you can sell somebody on Derek Williams or Aaron Aflalo or something and get something that way. And, of course, Melo would be the big fish in that, but that's, of course, a more complicated situation. And that's another factor in this as well. When you're a team in a major market, that part of what you need to do is kind of clear the decks and get the most out of what you have. You can consider that a way of building assets where there aren't any in the first place.
I agree with you. Yeah, I mean, someone like David Lee or Gallo, I mean, a lot of those guys that they used to get Melo, they probably overpaid for him. But nonetheless, those guys were considered assets, Wilson Chandler, because D'Antoni had developed them. And there's really, I don't think you can look at anyone on the Knicks as that way. And then even the guys who have looked better, guys like Lance Thomas, who actually he injured his knee, he's going to miss some time now. Langston Galloway, those guys are now free agents, so they can't even really use those guys as assets anyway. Let's talk a little bit about the West playoff race before we get into the six-man talk. It basically seems to have become Dallas versus Utah for the eighth seed. Everyone else has above a 90% chance of making the playoffs now.
Yeah, Memphis has separated themselves, so they're, barring catastrophe, they're the five. And Dallas isn't going to be the team that jumps them, so we don't have to concern ourselves. And then Portland and Houston, it's a combination of factors. I think they're better teams on paper, they're playing well right now, and they have substantially easier schedules. So if you separate them kind of in another group, then it's Dallas and Utah. Dallas is still ahead of Utah, but they have a substantially harder schedule.
Yeah, the Jazz are actually, I still think, three games behind the Mavs, but the Jazz are given a 55% chance of making the playoffs, and the Mavs only 51% by 538. The Rockets are now at 94%. You win two games on the road that you weren't supposed to win against Toronto and against Boston, two good teams in the East that they were probably given, you know, 25% chance or less to win. That changes your playoff odds a ton when these odds are based on what the schedule is going forward. So I don't know. I'm feeling pretty good about my Mavs will not make it and Jazz will pick, but obviously the Jazz have to actually come through and win some of these games against bad teams.
Well, so here's a big example of how a single game can affect playoff odds. So the stat that you just said about, it was 53-51, right?
55-51.
So that was before they the Mavericks lost to the Pacers, because the updated odds after that game is Utah 63, Dallas 40.
Oh, yeah, I didn't refresh since that game ended, yeah.
So that's a pretty, that can give you an idea of how this can shift when you lose a game that you quote-unquote should win, and that was only one team, that so that made it a two-and-a-half game margin. And so, you know, that's a little illustration of how a system can affect that. And I'm not criticizing 538. I think that's a good way of doing it, but it's just amazing how losing a home game to the Pacers can do it. But okay, on schedule, there are a lot of different ways to look at it, but in terms of strength of schedule, so how much your opponents are winning, Dallas's opponents for the remainder of the way, and this includes the Pacers, have a winning percentage of 58.4, which is really good. You know, that's almost 60%.
Yeah.
And Utah's is 48.1. So their average opponent is below 500. And so, yeah, it's a 2.5 game margin, but that is a substantial difference in quality.
Yeah. And there is a game that they play. It's the tail end of a back to back for both teams. And that will be the tiebreaker because they have split their first two there. They only play three times. So that'll be a critical game, obviously, for them. I mean, I think Utah is looking pretty decent, but I think injuries also could be huge in deciding this. And, you know, Dallas, what have they lost, five straight now?
That sounds right.
Yeah, that is pretty rough. And they've lost those games. I mean, and what really killed them were those losses to the Kings and Nuggets. Those are games they really needed to win and should have won. And now they are getting into such a hard part of the schedule that they don't have that big cushion against the Jazz any longer. You want to talk six men?
Sure, let's do it.
All right, so you wrote about this. Who were your main candidates that you considered?
The six man of the year this year is actually pretty well balanced. It's one of those things where it's partially a matter of taste. But so the five that I seriously considered were Enes Kanter, Will, and this is in any order, Enes Kanter, Will Barton, Andre Iguodala, Ed Davis, and Drew Holiday, who I just now realize are all in the Western Conference.
yeah, actually, not a ton of candidates in the East. I might have considered Kelly Olynyk as well, although the fact that he's now missed some pretty significant time, that might end up disqualifying him. Bismack Biyombo might be another guy I would consider. What about Corey Joseph? You didn't consider him?
I probably should have. I think his statistical profile just wasn't really at the level of Drew, and so it was kind of the idea was, well, if you're going to go with a point guard, Drew has a really great profile. It's weird to even think of him for me as a sixth man, considering he plays starter minutes and is better than the starter. But that's just because of his injury. That's the way it happened with them, and that makes him one of those players that can win a weird sixth man of the year award. Different than Isaiah last year, who, you know, Isaiah was a sixth man for parts of his career and then now is a starter, whereas Drew has basically always been a starter, and then he basically slummed it for a year and could win sixth man of the year.
Yeah, and so the criteria to be eligible, and I'm going to go by the criteria, is that you start less than half the games.
Yeah, half the games
start,
you play.
Start less than 40. Is it half the games you play?
I believe so, yes.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, and So, yeah, I mean, Ryan Anderson, also another guy that you consider. I think just he's not good enough on defense. And I'm even – Drew has just been so awesome, and he definitely is not the problem there in New Orleans. So that's maybe why I would consider him.
Manu, if he played more, would be
– yeah.
I think he would have been the front runner if he hadn't missed the time due to his testicular surgery.
David West is actually very high in the RPM rankings and, you know, was a starter quality player, certainly as recently as last year. The Spurs have had really one of the best benches in NBA history. He's someone that maybe we probably should give a little bit more consideration to.
Yeah, David West is having a great year. It's pretty incredible how many guys there are. And the other one that's a really weird six-man of the year case, again, another guy who's starting now, is Aaron Gordon. Depending on what stats you like, in terms of PER, I think he's towards the top. I don't think his RPM is great right now, but the Magic are kind of a weird team for things like that. But he's technically eligible.
Yeah, that's true. Although I mean, he's more Miles Turner would probably end up being eligible as well. But yeah, I think those guys are just the teams have not performed quite well enough with them on the floor. I mean, Jamal Crawford is another guy that people always consider as well, but he's I think has finally lost enough efficiency to where I wouldn't really consider him. And I thought the fact that he won in 2014 over Taj Gibson was a joke anyway. So I don't know. Who did you ultimately think you should give it to?
So I ultimately went with Andre Iguodala because I think there's a lot of value that he creates that isn't really a part of the, you know, the standard stats and all that. And his defensive value to the Warriors is huge. The team defends at their best when he's out there on the floor, which is amazing when Draymond Green is probably going to finish second for Defensive Player of the Year again, and deservedly so. And that's been especially relevant this year because Festus Ezeli has missed time due to his knee injury, and they don't have a ton of, you know, defensive foundational pieces, you know, the kind of guys that make everything else work. And also something that I give a lot of credence to is Iguodala is a part of a historically great team, and he is an integral part of that. I was thinking about it, and I hadn't really considered this before I wrote the piece, but I think you could make an argument, and I would, that he has been the fourth most valuable Warrior this year.
I think you could. On the other hand, he's averaging 7 points a game, 3.5 assists, 4.1 rebounds, and 12.6 PR. Obviously a guy who's very vastly underrated by his box score stats, as you noted. But man, I think if we're putting on our hat of who actually will win it, it's a tough call, right? The Warriors are having this great season. He also is famous now because he was the MVP. The fact that he has sacrificed so much has been discussed a ton as well. So I think he's in everyone's consciousness. And I think if you had to say I could have one of these guys on my team, I'd probably rather have Drew, maybe. But, you know, I think that would be close. And Andre would definitely be the guy who would be second. Cancer, to me, hasn't played enough minutes. I mean, you can look at that off the bench. I mean, these are guys who should be playing like 30 minutes a game if you're that good, and he's playing like 20 or something in competitive games. And obviously his defense, too.
And the other difference why I think it should be Drew versus Andre is that both of them close. So they get those high leverage minutes and their teams think highly enough of them. And while some might say that's not a traditional six-man thing, in certain circumstances like Manu Ginobili, it was. So I think that helps them, even though Drew's team sucks. I still think that your team making that decision helps your case.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, Manu, it was unbelievable on a permanent basis. If he had just played more, I think it would definitely be him. And hey, if Andre misses 2-3 weeks with this ankle injury, maybe that kind of changes things. But I would ultimately go with Iguodala, I think, as well, just especially because of what the team has done and what his sacrifice has meant to the Warriors, even if that's a little bit overrated. The fact that he still has been willing to do it and not complain too much, that ultimately moves the needle because he just is sort of the ethos of exactly what the sixth man is kind of supposed to be.
Another thing that I hadn't strongly considered before it was that he does fit a lot of the profile of the sixth man, that he plays with the backups, but he also plays minutes with starters. I think he's about 27 a game. And one thing we talked about how he closes games that I also considered kind of adjacent to the history thing is he is an integral part of the death lineup. And that's the best lineup. It's being a little bit, you could call it quote unquote underutilized just because they don't need to. But I think that helps him, too, that he is a mandatory part. You missed it because you were on the East Coast, but Kerr talked about that because he didn't really run much of Draymond at center while Iguodala was out. even though their center spot was weak, you know, with Festus being out. And the reason he said was because Andre is mandatory to make the defense work.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think he, Drew, and then David West. Nobody realizes what David West is doing. Let me read you some stats from him. 59 true shooting percentage, 17.8 PER, and rebounding really well, and they played great with him on the floor. So I think that when you consider all that, he shot incredibly well for mid-range. They've held up in a lineup that seems like it wouldn't work with him and Diaw together. That's actually been great. Tim Duncan sits out all the time. He plays very few minutes. West is almost never going to close if Duncan is healthy. But nonetheless, he's having a great year, and I think someone from the Spurs deserves a lot of credit. So he would either be number two or number three to me, and depending on kind of how all these guys close the year, he might even win it. I think he should be getting more attention because people thought, oh, you know, he's not really that important. He's on a minimum contract. He's been huge for what the Spurs have been able to do this year.
And he's a model for kind of what those competitive teams are going to need from a player like that. And I think Cleveland, as great as they've been, you know, the guy who just goes in there and can scale up or down his minutes based on how it works, I think that's something that at a couple different positions would be good for them to have.
Yeah, West only playing 17.4 minutes a game. That would probably be a little bit of a demerit for him. But he has played, he's started 17 games and he's played 64. So he's basically playing just about every game. So, yeah, I mean, he definitely should deserve more. And everyone on the Spurs, especially veterans, are just not going to play as many minutes. So the low minute total doesn't bother me as much as it does for someone like Cantor, where he just has these limitations where he really can't play more minutes.
Yeah, and Cantor, it's also hard because we crap on his defense all the time, but I think that he's the guy who benefits so much from box score stats, and so I think you just internally discredit those a lot more with him just because you know that they're going to be puffed up.
I agree. All right, anything else we got to talk about? Should we get going here?
I don't think there's anything we have to. I'm excited to see now with Jay. I mean, obviously we don't want Jay Crowder to be out, but now the East is a lot more of a free for all, and to see whether that actually affects the way these teams are thinking about it all, because now the three seed is in play for Charlotte and all that, and I think that makes a meaningful difference for them because that seed is so much more desirable than anything else around it.
Yeah, I think that fifth seed is really undesirable. You don't have home court, and you're in the Cavs bracket. You know, so are teams going to start engineering and tanking? Well, we will have plenty of Dunktown episodes to discuss all of those things as the playoffs come up. We're coming up pretty close to our one-year anniversary, actually. I remember when we first started, it was the week before the playoffs. We were talking about teams kind of trying to engineer their seeding a little bit.
Yeah, so yeah, I think the anniversary is a little less than a month away.
Oh, boy. Well, happy anniversary. Happy early anniversary, Danny. I'll make sure not to forget and to like get you a present or a card or something.
I appreciate it.
All right, man. That'll do it for today. Follow us on Twitter. Danny is Danny LaRue. I am Nate Duncan, NBA. And if you want to support the program, that cap space code on Helix Sleep or SeatGeek, great way to do so. Also, an iTunes review or rating is a great way to support the program as well. We use that all the time with the sponsors to get more on, and we've actually had a little bit of success with that, so that'll help us keep that endeavor going.
Can I do a quick promo first?
Absolutely.
So I released a piece that I've been working on for a while on the Sporting News, which I call The Space Race. It has a longer title, but that's what I call it. And the idea was, what I've been working on for a while, is to try to convey how crazy July is going to be. And so I went through kind of the structural things. I ended up calculating it separately, but coming up with a number very similar to the $1 billion that Tom Ziller on SB Nation had a while ago. And so I talked about the timeline and all that kind of stuff. And so if you want to kind of get a sense in the written word of something that that Nate and I have talked about a lot, you can take a look at that. And then I also published a piece on RealGM saying a little bit about how I came to it. I don't give the hard numbers because that's my own stuff. But about how the kind of the logic, because there are different ways of getting to a total number. And so I explained kind of how I did it.
Yeah, I'll look forward to reading that. And I'm almost, you know, I kind of wish that we were doing our mock off season like tomorrow, just so I could have my own idea of like what guys are really going to get, you know, because we've kind of been thinking about it, but you really have to just go through that exercise to figure it out. It's really, I think, the only way that I know of to do it. But, you know, so much is going to happen between now and then. It probably wouldn't really be useful. So, all right. Good job. Promote a show that's going to occur 3 months from now, Nate. So let's call it quits for today. We'll talk to you all next time.